Thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a show that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, you can follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram with @FisheriesPod. You can support the podcast on Patreon, which helps pay for various parts of the show. And if that isn't your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on the Teespring store. My name is Anders Halverson, and our guest today is Kevin Rogers. Kevin has a pair of undergraduate degrees from the University of Colorado Boulder, as well as a master's and PhD in fisheries science from Colorado State University. He has worked for Colorado Parks and Wildlife for the last 26 years, spending the last 18 as the state's native cutthroat trout research scientist. His research efforts cover all aspects of cutthroat trout conservation, management, and taxonomy. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Kevin, what I'd really love to chat with you about today is your work on cutthroat trout in Colorado, a subject that's near and dear to my heart. And I wonder if we could start with you, and probably it'll take us a while, with the long and tangled saga of the greenback cutthroat trout. So could you sort of walk us through that and maybe even start it at the very beginning, 70,000 years ago?
Actually, it turns out it seems like their evolutionary history goes back a lot further than that.
Okay.
So although Behnke thought the split between rainbows and cutthroat trout occurred like 2 million years ago, both the fossil record and the new genetic data suggest the split was closer to like 10 million years ago. So that means greenbacks were on the Front Range in Colorado longer than we previously thought. But with European colonization and those Front Range streams end up facing a variety of challenges, from rampant mining and timber harvest early on to probably the biggest threat has been the introduction of non-native salmonids, brook trout in particular, that outcompete native cutthroat trout when they're living together, basically because they're fall spawners, and so they hatch a little earlier, and it's that competition in the first year of life that really favors brook trout over cutthroat trout.
So let's talk about that for just a little more. So we're talking about the 19th century here. The greenback cutthroat trout were the native trout to the eastern slope of Colorado. So that's the Arkansas drainage and the South Platte drainage, right?
Right. So that was the thought at the time. And that was basically based on work that David Starr Jordan had done in the late 1800s before he went on to become the, Chancellor of Stanford University? Or the
first president, I think. Yeah.
President, I guess it was. Yeah. So so that work, his work suggested that they were the native trout of the South Platte and Arkansas Basin. And so that's kind of what we went with. And they basically were thought to have gone extinct back in the 30s. And then in the 50s, there was a couple populations that were found, and Dr. Behnke at Colorado State University kind of dug into those.
So that's a sort of fascinating. You just went pretty quickly through that. But so they thought this fish was extinct. And then Robert Behnke he actually had some indication that there were some weird fish up in Como Creek above Boulder, right?
Exactly, from folks that were working at that experiment station up there. And so anyway, he had gone through some museum specimens and basically the work that Jordan and others had done early on and deemed that those, in fact, were good greenbacks based on morphological characters or, visual characteristics. And so that really got the recovery effort underway, and it was really one of the shining stars of the endangered species program early on. So mm-hmm. Here you have this fish that we thought was extinct, found a few populations. It actually was listed on the original endangered species list when the act was first passed in the 70s. And so that recovery effort then got underway. And
so this was an exciting thing that was going on, restoring these greenback. Everyone was excited to be restoring these fish.
I don't know if everyone was excited, okay. But certainly not a lot of people were. One of the challenges with an endangered species listing is that you're not allowed to take or can't even fish for them. And so that was a challenge for anglers that, you know, had fished waters that were then being reclaimed and having greenbacks put in them. And so early on, they were able to get them downlisted to threatened status, which allowed for catch and release angling. And I think at that point, the support really grew for trying to, you know, get this native fish reestablished in its former range. And so that went on for a number of years, and we were actually in the process of writing up the management plan that would allow for delisting completely, because we'd met the recovery objectives in the recovery plan.
And this was what, early 2000 or so?
Early 2000s. And so, you know, we're in the process of having that thing taken off the endangered species list entirely.
So you'd spent, or not you personally, but the agency had spent 30 years recovering and trying to restore these to different locations. And
exactly. Not just Colorado Parks and Wildlife, but also the Fish and Wildlife Service and Forest Service partners that, you know, a lot of people were involved. But then, so about that time, Jessica Metcalf was doing her PhD work at CU. And one of the things we'd always sort of aspired to was being able to tell greenback cutthroat trout apart from Colorado River cutthroat trout. And so Benke's work suggested there were kind of these subtle differences in visual traits, like the greenbacks had bigger spots and the Colorado Rivers had more spots. But there was a lot of overlap between the two, and so you couldn't consistently tell them apart by just visual characteristics. And so the default had become, okay, if you're on the east side of the divide, you're greenbacks. If you're on the west side, you're Colorado River cutthroat trout. But we really wanted to have a way to tell them, and the new molecular tools that were coming out seemed like a good way to do that. And in fact, some folks in Montana and Utah had at the University of Montana and BYU in Utah had done some work with molecular tools and found same sort of thing, that there was just too much overlap to consistently tell them apart. And I remember at that time, you know, people asking Dr. Benke, well, you know, should these even be separate subspecies if you can't tell them apart with these molecular tools? And he thought, well, you know, it was convenient for management to be able to have these. Just because the greenbacks were a listed entity. So then Jessica Metcalf came in and started working with cutthroats, and again, with some even newer molecular tools, thought wanted to tackle that same question as far as, you know, developing a way to identify the two. And through her work, there was a 2007 paper that she published that suggested that about half of the populations on the east side of the divide that were being managed is greenback cutthroat trout actually were much more closely related to Colorado River cutthroat trout, specifically those from Trapper's Lake, than other greenbacks. And that, of course, really shook up the whole recovery effort, because that was, you know.
Yeah, I remember that was a bombshell, right? Yes, just a complete bombshell in the whole thing.
It was not great news, since we were in the process of trying to get this thing delisted. But it was really compelling information, and then we started really digging into, there weren't good stocking records from back then, but Chris Kennedy in particular with the Fish and Wildlife Service, sort of a closet historian, and he really dug into just old newspaper articles.
That was a heck of a lot of work that he did.
A lot of work kind of piecing together a stocking history of what went on back then. And I think, you know, we realized that we had been taking eggs at Trapper's Lake for a long time, but I don't think we appreciated the magnitude of what we'd been doing. I know I'd found an article in the Steamboat Pilot up here that suggested in 1903 and 1904, a couple million eggs had been moved to this hatchery that it was in Steamboat at the time. Basically, the Yacht Club restaurant used to be a hatchery. And
that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So to clarify, so Trapper's Lake is on the west side of the divide.
Exactly. So Trapper's Lake sits at the headwaters of the White River. And that historically was the largest population of Colorado River cutthroat trout anywhere on the planet. And those fish run up Cabin Creek. And it turns out that starting in 1903, we started taking eggs there, originally bringing them to Steamboat Springs to raise up and then moving down to Glenwood Springs. But, you know, by 1908, we took as many as 10 million eggs a year out of there. And so from 1903 to 1938, which was when they sort of suspended operations at Trappers Lake because there was some there was a population crash, and so they kind of held off, and then World War II got going, so there was a pause in the egg take operations. But from 1903 to 1938, it looks like we probably made close to 100 million pure Colorado River cutthroat trout, and we stocked them all over the state, basically any place that could take them got them. In fact, there was an article from Sports Afield in 1911 that suggested that, you know, the Forest Service was saying that the Game and Fish Commission, so the what was the Colorado Parks and Wildlife, didn't have the staff to stock every fishless water in the state, and so by God they were going to help us. So yeah, and my predecessors certainly weren't lazy, and they got after it, and so a lot of the waters in the state got stocked, fishless waters in particular, and the fish did well, particularly in fishless waters, because those generally were fishless because there was a barrier that kept non-native salmonids from moving in. And so if you had these waters that wouldn't allow brook trout to get in and not compete cutthroats, the cutthroats would do really well.
Now, just to add another topic that's near to my heart, what about the rainbow trout? How much effort was being put into stocking rainbow trout at this time?
Rainbows were going out a lot as well, but they didn't seem to, you know, that they're bad for a different reason when mm-hmm. it comes to cutthroat trout fisheries. They're a sister taxa, so they can actually hybridize with cutthroat trout. Mm-hmm. So if rainbows get in with cutthroats, you end up losing, you know, the pure form of cutthroat trout and end up with this hybrid swarm. But it really was the brook trout that, and still is, that are the bigger problem for cutthroats, just because we've already relegated cutthroats to these high elevation habitats. You know, historically they would have interacted with rainbows more frequently, but now it's
the brook trout. Gotcha.
It's really the brook trout that are the bigger deal. Mm-hmm.
And the brook trout, of course, are native to the east and were brought over
exactly.
here.
Exactly. So in terms of native salmonids, where these salmonids are native, the rainbows are native to the Pacific Northwest, brook trout to the East Coast, and brown trout to Europe. And all three of those non-native can cause problems, you know, particularly with our Rio Grande cutthroat trout. Brown trout seem to be a bigger problem in those warmer habitats down south.
So this is all sort of a... thanks to Chris Kennedy, that it became apparent just how many Colorado River cutthroat were being spread all over the west side, I mean, the east side of the Continental Divide.
Right. So that kind of sleuthing really corroborated what we'd been finding with the genetic data. And so at that point, then Jessica had suggested that, okay, half are, you know, these are actually Colorado River fish that were stocked on the east side of the divide and the other half are greenbacks. About that time, you know, we realized that, okay, we need to survey basically all our cutthroat populations and figure out what we have where. And one thing that became pretty apparent is that these fish that we thought were greenbacks on the east side of the divide were cropping up in a lot of places on the west side. And in fact, more places on the west side than they were on the east side. And then again, with some of Chris Kennedy's work, realized that we had some hatchery operations, fish culture operations, particularly on the Grand Mesa over toward Grand Junction, where we were producing a lot of fish and moving them to the east side of the divide as well. And so then the question became, well, you know, what if these other ones aren't greenback either, but just another thing that was native to the west slope that got moved over to the east side? So at that point, we realized, okay, we need to go back to all these museum collections and figure out, you know, what was where historically before Europeans came on the landscape. And, you know, we're actually pretty lucky. I mean, there were people that were collecting fish and stuffing them in jars quite often in the late 1800s. In fact, this guy Hammond, who was a Army surgeon in the 1850s before the Civil War, was stationed out at Fort Riley in Kansas and was going around the West scouting these wagon roads and collecting samples to put in jars. So we actually have quite a few specimens in museums, you know, sort of the premier museums scattered around the country, the California Academy of Sciences, Smithsonian, Harvard. And fortunately for us, they, you know, formalin hadn't really been invented, or it wasn't widely used yet. So everything was stored in alcohol. And the reason that's important is that formalin basically destroys our ability to look at the DNA, whereas alcohol preserves it well. And so, well, not well, but it does preserve it. And so we went back and we managed to talk Jessica into doing a postdoc and coming back from some work she was doing with ancient DNA in Australia. So she had the skills to really dig into this DNA that, you know, even though it was stored in ethanol or in alcohol, it was really degraded. And so she had to use some pretty sophisticated techniques to be able to get usable information from that DNA. But with all those collections, we were able to piece together a pretty good map of what was on the landscape historically before Europeans showed up. And so that was a paper that was published in 2012 and basically showed that instead of just four subspecies of cutthroat trout, so historically we thought we had the greenbacks on the east side of the divide, Colorado River's on the west side, Rio Grande cutthroat trout in the San Luis Valley going on down into New Mexico, and then the yellowfin cutthroat trout, which was thought to be endemic to Twin Lakes at the headwaters of the Arkansas, that went extinct around 1903. So that's what we thought we had, but it turns out that basically every major drainage basin had its own lineage. So you have a lineage that was unique to the South Platte Basin. That yellowfin, it looked like we found some samples outside of Twin Lakes, and there were other accounts that suggest that it wasn't just endemic to Twin Lakes, but in fact was the fish of the Arkansas Basin. It was just, it just got big in Twin Lakes because that's where, you know, the forage was for them.
Interesting. And
then in the Rio Grande Valley, the Rio Grande cutthroat trout, that nothing changed there. We had this, you know, a lineage that was native to that basin. And then on the west side in the range of Colorado River cutthroat trout, it looked like we had a lineage that was native to the White, Yampa, and Green River basin that we've called the blue lineage. Unfortunately, we like to get away from the colors and give them better names. But then there's one lineage native to the Colorado, Gunnison, and Dolores. And that was the green lineage, the one that we thought was greenback, and it too was stocked east of the divide. And then there was another lineage in the San Juan Basin that we had no current samples from. So we thought that one had gone extinct too. But obviously with that work, we started really pounding the bushes and canvassed all the samples we collected from any San Juan or cutthroat trout from the San Juan Basin. And lo and behold, found a half dozen populations of those that are still extant on the landscape. So they're not, we don't have a lot of them, they're tiny populations, but now it's just exciting to know that we still have some of those, and there's a, you know, intense recovery.
And you're talking about Colorado River cutthroat from
the San Juan. So this is one of the three lineages of Colorado River cutthroat trout that are native to the San Juan. So it's pretty amazing that, you know, we've lost over 90% of our native cutthroat trout habitat across the state, and yet we still have five of the six lineages that were here historically. So,
and I've always fantasized, I read somewhere, I don't know who said it, maybe it was Robert Behnke, that they transported yellowfin cutthroat to France at one point.
Yeah, there's a bunch of rumors. They thought they had moved some to the Grand Mesa to culture, and then some of those might have gone to Europe. There's some articles that suggest that, but the problem is that back then, first they called all cutthroat trout black spotted trout, and so that kind of made things confusing. And then, you know, we're not really sure whether the fish, they do show up in the records on those Grand Mesa operations as being yellowfin cutthroat trout, but we're not really sure whether that actually happened or whether there was just a marketing tool and they just called them yellowfins because that's what they were calling them on the east side of the divide.
Okay.
So,
well, still, it would be a fun excuse to go to France and go fishing. I know.
I'd love to have the state pay to have me go tromp around in Central Europe. But yeah, I don't know. We've looked hard for evidence of yellowfins in Colorado and haven't found any. But yeah, there's always hope. And there's certainly a number of folks that are chasing leads anytime we hear anything about it. Or, you know, I'd love it if somebody had an old mount, you know, in a garage somewhere, particularly if somebody's down in the Arkansas Basin, which would have been the native range of these fish. To, you know, if they've got a dusty old cutthroat trout that's been buried in the attic, love to take a piece of a fin off one of those, mm-hmm, and see if there's any evidence of yellowfin in it.
Interesting. Okay, so we just went on a long tangent away from the saga of the greenback cutthroat trout. So I think we were in 2012 at this point, right. And now it looks like all these fish that you had thought, or the agencies had thought, were greenback cutthroat trout turned out to be Colorado River cutthroat trout.
Right.
These are populations that have been, people have been restoring to other waters, right, all around the Front Range. So then what happens? So
that was all but one. So there was one population early on that we discovered in the 90s that we tested to look for rainbow hybridization with rainbows or hybridization with Yellowstone cutthroat trout, and hadn't found it in there. But these fish didn't look quite right. I mean, they just had spots on the belly and par marks even in the adults, and they just looked weird. And so even though they tested pure and were on the east side of the divide, we never included them in the brood stock for the greenback recovery program just because they look different.
That's ironic. And, yep.
Yeah. And so then it turns out that those fish actually are the only ones that have the genetic fingerprint that matches what was in the South Platte Basin historically. And so that was pretty exciting. And the interesting thing is, ironically, they aren't in the South Platte Basin. They're right on the north slope of Pikes Peak outside of Colorado Springs. So in the Arkansas Basin. So the some more sleuthing from Chris Kennedy suggested that there was this would-be hotelier on the north slope of Pikes Peak. That used to be a really popular hike up to the summit of Pikes Peak going through Jones Park. And this guy Jones, who homesteaded up there, figured he'd put a hotel up halfway up the trail so that people didn't have to do the 18-mile journey all in one fell swoop. And he built some ponds for his guests. And the thought is that he stocked those ponds with fish that were either purchased from the private sector, and there were two private hatcheries that were raising cutthroat trout in the late 1800s that he could have bought fish from, or he could have got them himself. Either way, the closest trout population to Jones Park is over near Trout Creek in the South Platte Basin. And actually, that's where the two private hatcheries were collecting fish for their operations. So we're not sure where he got the fish from, but sounds like he collected fish from the South Platte Basin, put them in his ponds. Those fish escaped the ponds and then established in this fishless stream that's above a waterfall barrier. So would have been fishless historically. And those fish have persisted in that little drainage for the last 140 years.
And this is just a tiny little stream.
Tiny little stream. Creek, about really. 700 individuals in the population. And, you know, who knows how many he actually stocked in the ponds and how many actually got out and founded the population. Certainly a serious genetic bottleneck when you do that sort of thing, establish populations with low numbers of individuals. And we see that in the genetics of these fish. There's basically no variation between them, but they still seem to persist. And so we've used those then to establish a new wild brood lake on top of Cameron Pass so that we can generate larger numbers. And we also have a brood stock at the Leadville Federal Hatchery and have used those to establish new populations across the Front Range.
So you're going about this. So at this point, you've realized that the initial attempts to restore the greenback cutthroat trout from 1970s up to 2000s was using the wrong fish. And so now you are starting over basically with and all you have is one tiny population of 700 fish. That's all that's left of the species, of the subspecies, to try to restore that. Are you removing some of the previously restored what you had thought were greenback cutthroat trout?
Unfortunately, we've had to do that in some situations. I mean, certainly our focus would be on trying to remove brook trout populations and restore these cutthroats into brook trout populations. But in some cases, the habitat that was restored previously is either the best habitat or habitat that's the most secure because it already has barriers in place. So in some situations, we have replaced the blue lineage ones with these Bear Creek fish.
And how are you, if you need to eliminate the fish, are you using electrofishing or are you using rotenone, or how are you going about it?
Yeah, we use rotenone. Okay. That's a natural piscicide derived from this Daris root in the Amazon that's been used for thousands of years to collect fish with, and it works really well for these kinds of reclamations. Trying to just do mechanical removal with electrofishing doesn't work unless you've got a very small reach a stream that's not complex at all. Otherwise, the brook trout especially are just, they just get everywhere, and so it's virtually impossible to remove them just with electrofishing. Yeah, this rotenone works really well, and so generally we'll put in a barrier to prevent further upstream migration of brook trout, and then clear out the fish that are above the barrier and put the native cutthroat trout back in.
So how many populations now have you established of what we now think are greenback cutthroat trout?
Well, I guess established is a big word. So we've brought them back to half dozen or so streams at this point, and have many more in the work. But really, they're not to be considered established. You want to make sure that they're able to reproduce on their own naturally and produce that wild population. And so that takes time. And some of the first projects we did are just now, those fish are just getting old enough to where we would be able to see natural recruitment. And so we're monitoring that, but certainly expecting them to do fine. I mean, that's one thing we've gotten pretty good at, is establishing trout populations on the landscape. So we're excited to have those populations out there and looking forward to documenting natural recruitment. And
now, are these, what's their status on the endangered species list now?
So right now they're still listed as threatened. Okay. And the Fish and Wildlife Service is going to be reviewing that status here in the not too distant future. And so that's one reason we're trying to get a number of populations established before that review is made, just to demonstrate that we're able to get them back out there. We did this recovery program once, we can do it again.
And are people able to fish for them yet?
Yeah, you can fish for them in the headwaters of Poudre River. We've got some up there, and we're looking to in some of the other headwater streams. Try not to advertise locations too much yet. Okay. But certainly, if we move forward, there'll be more and more opportunities to catch those fish.
Okay, so that is the long and twisted saga of the greenback cutthroat trout up to this point. Did I miss anything? There was one more twist that we didn't discuss, which was that the type specimen for greenback cutthroat trout wasn't even a greenback cutthroat trout, right?
Yeah, so there's always been confusion around the type specimen, because it just showed up in a box at the Philadelphia Academy of Sciences labeled Fort Riley 1856. And that's where Hammond was stationed. And so everything in that box got labeled Fort Riley 1856. So Dr. Behnke had assumed that he had heard about this expedition to chart a wagon road from Fort Riley to Bridger Pass, so that folks, settlers coming west, could go from Fort Riley up to the Oregon Trail. And so the thought was that Hammond was on that expedition and collected these fish. And if he was on that expedition, he would have crossed the South Platte Basin and been able to collect cutthroat trout at that place. It turns out that actually Hammond wasn't on the 1856 expedition. The 1856 expedition did happen, and they suffered some casualties at the time. And so in order to get workers to go on the 1857 expedition to kind of shore up the wagon road, they had to bring an army or a surgeon along, and that surgeon was Hammond, and he was sort of a fan of naturalia, as he called it, would collect all kinds of things. And the neat thing is, from his notes, he had these 14 pages of detailed notes from all the collections he made, not just of fish, but of insects and a whole bunch of stuff. You could basically follow the route that he took out and back. And it turns out that on the way back, they did indeed cross the Poudre River Basin, and that would have been a logical place for them to collect cutthroat trout and bring those back. But the odd thing is that his notes all have 1857 written on them rather than 1856. And although you might, get the dates wrong, usually you don't get the years wrong. So that was kind of curious, that the collections at the museum all had an 1856 date. And so I did a bunch more digging and realized that it turns out that prior to being stationed at Fort Riley, Hammond was actually stationed in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And one thing that's curious is if you look at that type specimen, the DNA in the type specimen matches fish from the Rio Mora today, which is right outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico. And so, in fact, the type specimen for greenback is really a Rio Grande cutthroat trout. And it sounds like Hammond brought his collection of stuff that he collected down while he was in Santa Fe with him to Fort Riley, probably boxed it all up that winter and put Fort Riley 1856 on the box. And so all of the collections in that box got labeled with Fort Riley, Kansas. And that, you know, part of that confusion all started because we know that trout never exist, or cutthroat trout never existed in out in Kansas, at least not in in recent history. So that always was sort of curious that those fish had Fort Riley, Kansas as their type location. We knew they came from somewhere else, but yeah, just had assumed that they had come from the South Platte Basin, when in fact these modern molecular techniques allowed us to see that in fact those type specimens were Rio Grande cutthroat trout. And what's even more interesting is, you know, one of the traits we always attribute to greenback cutthroat trout are these big spots, few spots, but large ones pushed towards the tail of the fish. And if you look within Rio Grande cutthroat trout, the ones in the Pecos River drainage have just those traits, fewer spots, even relative to other Rio Grande cutthroat trout. They have these fewer large spots pushed towards the tail. And so it's sort of interesting that that has became associated with a trait for greenback cutthroat trout.
Yeah, no kidding.
When in fact, it's more consistent with Rio Grande.
Hmm. When did you figure this out about the type specimen for the greenback?
That was all around the same time. So Jessica had, actually, I remember that she had called and a little freaked out because when she had done that museum work, you know, she ran the tests a number of times and it kept coming back with the same answer that these type specimens were Rio Grandes, not greenbacks. And so that's what obviously perplexed me and got me into digging for what Hammond's history was in particular, and why it was that these fish looked like Rio Grandes instead of greenbacks. So it's kind of a fascinating way to marry old archive records with modern molecular tools to kind of inform what happened 150 years ago.
Yeah, I agree. What a fascinating intersection of history and archives and DNA and all with pretty important ramifications for conservation and just in general management, because thanks to the Endangered Species Act, this has implications beyond just the fish.
Right.
Yeah. And now we've just covered one little subspecies of cutthroat trout, and I know you've worked on restoring Rio Grande cutthroat trout and Colorado River cutthroat trout, and so I think we probably shouldn't go into those now. I think we're running out of time, but what a fascinating story.
Yeah, it's pretty intriguing, that's for sure.
So what does the future hold for the greenback cutthroat in particular?
Well, I think for all these, you know, our focus is trying to make sure we don't lose any more of the pieces. You know, like I said earlier, I think it's really neat that even though we've lost cutthroat trout from 90% of their former range, that we still have five of the six lineages out there. We still have a lot of the genetic diversity that was there historically still remains. And so I want to make sure that we don't lose any more and that we can pass that diversity on to our next generation of biologists and managers, and that we can keep these subspecies going.
Although even that is trickier than it sounds because of the inbreeding problem, right? You only had 700 fish to start with.
Right. So that's, you know, one thing that, you know, like I said, we worry about genetic bottlenecks. In the wild, the fish look great. We do see some deformities in the hatchery, basically because in the hatchery, everybody gets to live. There's not much selection pressure against deformities. And so, you know, I think first we want to preserve those pieces that represent, you know, what was in the South Platte Basin historically. But I certainly could envision down the road maybe bringing in some genetic diversity from the closest relatives, similar to what they've done with, say, Florida panthers, just to improve the fitness of the fish.
So that, we know, more specifically, that means potentially interbreeding them with a Colorado River cutthroat?
Potentially, or a Rio Grande, but at only, you know, only once we've secured the source population and replicated that in a number of places. But we do know that at least in a hatchery setting, those Bear Creek fish or the new greenback cutthroat trout that we rediscovered in the Arkansas Basin, we know that their survival is about half what it is for other wild cutthroat trout populations that we culture, and that their growth is about half. So those are certainly characteristics that are consistent with a genetic bottleneck and might make it harder for them to establish in the wild. But again, we first need to see how they do in the wild in these other populations that we've reclaimed, and before we, you know, look at alternative steps. You know, if they're able to do it on their own, great. But if they struggle, that's likely one reason they'd be struggling, and we might try entertaining bringing in some genetic diversity to help them.
And that is going to be fantastically controversial.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, it's not like we have to be that they're mutually exclusive.
Right.
I mean, I think we can we can secure what we have now in a number of populations across the landscape, so we don't lose that piece. But in some of these bigger reclamation projects, like I know we've got one going in the headwaters of the Poudre that's going to cover some 35 miles of stream. And if you've got, you know, a fish that's gone through this kind of bottleneck, you know, is it going to be able to do well in that setting? Or are you going to, you know, and you could either try and wait for mutations to occur on their own and to have it build genetic diversity on its own. But the question is that population going to last long enough for that to happen if it does have these consequences of a genetic bottleneck that hurt its fitness? But, you know, these fish were able to do just fine for 150 years in Bear Creek. So hopefully they'll do well in these other streams as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I don't think the Endangered Species Act even has, how to deal with hybrids under the Endangered Species Act is still controversial.
Right. So there are, you know, have been some work with West Slope cutthroat trout that basically showed that if it was less than, 20%. If it was better than 80% pure, that basically you couldn't visually tell them apart from the pure fish. And so at least in the Fish and Wildlife Service's eyes, those were counting as pure West Slope cutthroat trout.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know that, I mean, we certainly don't want to go that route if we don't have to, but I think it's more, you know, and it wouldn't take much. There's a lot of research that's gone into this genetic rescue, like I mentioned, for, you know, not just for fish, but for lots of species that have, you know, been reduced to even fewer numbers than these cutthroat trout have, like those Florida panthers. And just bringing in a couple of individuals is often enough to resolve the problems that bottleneck has created.
Fascinating. Okay. Is there anything else you want to add?
No, I think that about covers it. Just like I said, feel fortunate to have as much genetic diversity out there as we do, given the losses that we've incurred over the last century, and looking forward to making sure that diversity is secure for generations that follow and anglers that want to fish for them in the future.
All right. Well, great. Well, thank you, Kevin, so much for taking time to explain all of this to me.
My pleasure. It's definitely not it's a complicated story, but it's been a fun one to try and tease apart.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Kevin, and good luck.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I hope you have enjoyed this episode of the Fisheries Podcast with Kevin Rogers. If you want to find out more about cutthroat trout or Kevin's work, or if you want to get in touch with Kevin, go to the Colorado Parks and Wildlife website. There's a lot of material there. If you want to get a hold of me, you can get a hold of me through the Fisheries Podcast at the Fisheries Podcast website, on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, or you can send an email to feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. Remember that you can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite podcast listening app. You can stream it from Spotify, or you can just go to thefisheriespodcast.com and find the episodes there. And don't forget, you can support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon, or you can buy some gear at the Teespring store. I'm Anders Halvorsen, and thank you for listening.